Well, for a change of pace now, most of us have a clear idea of the kind of care we'd like at the end of our lives, yet, by and large, we put off talking about exactly that, the process of death and dying, until the final weeks, even days. What prevents us from having these conversations and preparing for the sort of death we say we'd like to have? Earlier this month, I spoke to four people who've been grappling with this particular issue. Dr. Kerry Noonan, a social researcher at the University of Western Sydney, Professor Imogen Mitchell, a senior intensive care specialist at the Canberra Hospital, Nikki Johnston, a palliative care nurse practitioner at Clare Holland House in Canberra, and Dr. Suzanne Rainsford. She's a rural GP providing palliative care services in southeast New South Wales.
Brigades of people here today. Okay, let's go to death literacy first, which is this very interesting idea, I know, Kerry Noonan, that you've really trying to normalise conversations around death and dying. What is the matter with the way we currently have conversations, or the neglect of them, which seems to be the main thing that you're concerned about?
Well, we're having conversations about death and dying too late. That's probably the key issue. We're having them in hospital when the proverbial kind of hits the fan, rather than way downstream, when there's lots of research to show if we have those conversations upstream from a health crisis, then you're more likely to have better conversations down the track.
It is believed, I mean, no one has the exact stats, that the majority of people, up to a half possibly, have conversations only in the last 2 days. That seems incredible. Do you think that's a fair comment?
Well, I think there are clinical conversations, which are in a medical setting, and there are social and family conversations that perhaps are less recognised in our broader conversations and perhaps even our research.
And your thesis, I think, is that we had more of these in times gone by.
Yes. I mean, let's not romanticise the amount of death that we had in the community 100 years ago, but certainly you had to kind of pull your sleeves up and get involved in death care. And certainly there's been a massive change over the last kind of century about the amount of hands-on care that we've been exposed to and that we do.
Now, Professor Mitchell, 2 days is surely far too late, isn't it?
That's only going to be my opinion. I mean, I suppose, you know, you mentioned the sort of sudden discussions about death, and I guess, you know, when I'm faced with an intensive care specialist in the middle of the night at weekends, you often get a sense that the family or patient has never had any inkling that this is about to happen. Now, I'm actually pretty certain that's not true. It's just probably it's never been translated perhaps in a way they fully understand. To me, it's about going, you know, upstream, painting the picture clearly with patients and their families or carers, such they know that the roadmap will, in the end, reach a certain point whereby there is nothing in terms of intervention to support cure, that we then move to another pathway to support symptom control, or, you know, actually decide where the place of death should be. So my challenge is, it's an in-the-middle-of-the-night conversation often, and it's often with an unprepared patient or family. And what can we do to actually change that as a community?
And the difficulty. And do you think it can be done?
Well, I think that, I mean, the answer has to be yes. Mm-hmm. The difficulty in the clinical environment is that we're not very well set up for that in as much as skill set. And secondly is, you know, as a medical oncologist told me, who is a wonderful communicator, she said, you know, I do not have outpatient time. We have 10 minutes per patient. There is no way you can have a proper end-of-life care conversation. So I think even structurally, we can change that.
But
I
not
think,
under the current system.
But I think it's quite challenging under the current
system.
And
Nikki Johnson, how do you see this?
I think what's really important with the work we're doing, so I actually work in the community and residential aged care, and we've taught people to identify people in their last 6 months of life, and then we actually do the conversation not in crisis. We sit down together, a GP, myself, the staff from the facility, the resident, the family, the alternate decision maker if there is one, and we talk about the goals of care. So It's not whether a hospital is right or wrong, it's whether does that fit the goal of care. So example is a lovely Italian gentleman that I was looking after. He had advanced dementia and was bedbound in a nursing home, and I met with his wife, and there was a question around, well, if he gets pneumonia again, does he go to hospital? And her first instinct was, of course he does. He's sick, he goes to hospital. And then going through, well, what's actually important to you now? What are we trying to achieve here? And it came out that it was actually much more important to keep him comfortable in a place that he knew. So by the end of that conversation, we kept him there. We didn't transfer him to hospital.
And how long did that take, that conversation?
Oh, about 2 hours.
Yes, right.
And do you know what, though? 2 hours of really good work and you get it all documented, you don't have to go back again.
Is that your experience, Dr. Raines? Does this ring true with what you...
The advanced care planning is not just a tick box. It really requires a conversation, which is time. And it may not be achieved in one session. It may be just starting the conversation about advanced care planning. But I think, you know, the GP is in a good position to assist with goals of care and planning, because there's a relationship
that is there. Dr. Noonan's talked about a trigger event often prompting these conversations, and I think what you're saying is get before the trigger event, which is invariably crisis-ridden. Now, how does that sound to you?
Yeah, I think it's really, really important. So the older folk with dementia, once they've lost capacity, it's then too late and it falls on the family. But if you can have that conversation beforehand, before they've lost capacity, then that really, you know, assists the family, assists the healthcare.
But does the family push back at some
point? Often, sometimes, so yeah, sometimes.
Because I can imagine they might, when they're not ready to yet have that conversation.
Yeah, yeah. But if you can have the conversation with the patient, with the person, and have a knowledge of what's important to them, then the GP, when they've lost capacity, or you know, they're in ICU or they're in aged care, if the GP has had a conversation with the patient, you know, beforehand and knows what's important, they can say to the family, well, look, I had a really good conversation with your mum, you know, 3 years ago, and she was really quite clear, this is what she wanted, this is what she didn't want.
But look, I was going to get onto it later, but the advanced care planning, again, that's a bit of a surprise when you start to look at it, how little advanced care plans are actually completed. And you're nodding here, Professor.
I guess we've looked both locally, actually, and across 9 hospitals across the nation in terms of the percentage of people dying in the acute care hospitals who have advanced care plans. And sort of generally, it's about 12% of people who die. And then if you get to the intensive care unit and they die, 3%. So it is currently not a pathway of engaging people in conversation. One of the challenges, certainly for an intensive care specialist, not that I come across it, as you can see, that often, but when you do, it's actually not that helpful because the context can be so challenging.
What do you mean?
In that, you know, it can be very specific as saying what they do and do not want. The difficulty is, I mean, as I had someone say to me, Imogen, I do not want to be resuscitated. And, you know, you sort of say, well, if you had aspirated on an Apple piece, do you want me just to watch at the age of 51? And you go, oh, you have a good point. So yes. I think, you know...
So healthy people can't quite imagine.
And I think, you know, you have to just be kind of cognizant of what context you're currently looking at. So I personally, at the moment, don't find how they're written as particularly helpful. I think what is helpful is to kind of get a sense of what's important to the patient into their dying days. And the families or carers need to have a big understanding of what that looks like.
Kerry?
Well, I wanted to add to that. I'm going to get a bit specific on the language here. An advanced care directive is the piece of paper where we write the directive down in advance. An advanced care plan is that kind of conversation. I think that's an important distinction and an important part of the conversation that we're having, because lots of people are having planning conversations and they can happen in all kinds of contexts. Certainly in the community, what I see is a lot of people having social conversations that are adding to people thinking about or at least understanding what an advanced care directive is.
But an advanced care plan conversation is the ideal.
And that it's that value stuff that takes time that Nikki's already talked about. If you know your neighbours and your mates and your girlfriends have actually written an advanced care directive, and that's talked about in a normal kind of context, then again, that kind of brings those conversations upstream. I don't think we have enough evidence yet or enough understanding of how those conversations in the community kind of trickle down to the actual piece of paper at the end. And then the piece of paper, how that actually changes, and Kathy and others might be able to talk directly to this, there is some conflicting evidence about what that directive does and doesn't do when you're at the coalface in emergency and other places.
Look, I think what I sort of take, though, is, see, all of this discussion, I think, still cuts across whether people even know how to prompt a conversation like this when they're healthy and well. A friend of mine a while ago started prepaying for a funeral, and we all said, my goodness, what's the matter? We were terribly worried. And I'm just listening to you all and thinking, well, we may not have actually helped her at all or ourselves because we cut it off, if you see what I mean. Now, Kerry Noonan, it seems to me this is what you really want to prompt. You want to prompt us to think about how we realistically, in a very coherent, constructive fashion, start introducing this more into our lives.
Yeah, look, there's no doubt it's hard. But I reckon one of the key things is starting to really recognise the normal everydayness of these conversations, that they are as much a part of thinking about planning for a wedding or planning for a vacation
or a birth.
I mean, the time we spend planning for a birth, yet we spend very little time planning well for death.
And if we don't plan for death, it's going to be bad. That's it. Full stop. We have to plan for it. And if we are able to plan and tell people what's important to us, you know, do you want to go outside? Do you want milk with your tea? You know, do you want your dog sitting by your bed? Who's important to you? Who's your family? We don't ask those questions.
No, because a lot of people may trust that this will actually take care of itself.
And it doesn't.
You know what I mean?
It doesn't. And often people end up in hospital and dying in hospital because we didn't have a conversation.
Now, I'm going to bring in Professor Mitchell here because I know this is this is something that you care about. Because, you know, the Grattan Institute, in its big 2014 discussion, Dying Well, said, in the last year of life, many experience a disconnected, confusing and distressing array of services, interventions and relationships with health professionals. Many do not get enough palliative care. Now, this whole argument that most people do not want to die in hospitals, I think you really question the rationality of that.
So I guess there's a couple of aspects to that. I mean, so we land up with the fact that most people are dying in acute hospitals. So that's the first issue. The second issue is, if we're going to experience dying, who should be involved in that dying process? Should it always engage specialist palliative care, or is there a group of patients who actually don't, in fact, need specialist palliative care? But the challenge I have with that, because, I mean, certainly, again, the local study and the national study that we undertook through Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare is about 30% of the 1,700 patients that we looked at dying see palliative care. So 70% are not seeing a specialist palliative care. That's not to say they didn't get palliative care type of relief of symptoms, but it's just saying that, you know, we have a resource that's either underutilized or more likely under-resourced. And I'm not a palliative care specialist, but I worry sometimes is that when we talk about end-of-life care, that the narrative is very much alongside the palliative care specialist, but they're actually not involved necessarily in every death that's happening in the acute care sector. So I think we need to speak more broadly about how we manage our patients at the end of life. Should we be involving palliative care more frequently, or are we, as you know, non-palliative care specialists, able to manage patients that they're dying? And I have to say, I'm not convinced, because having been involved in a number of deaths, as you can imagine, over the decades, I worry a lot that they do not get a good death.
if they're not in with sufficient palliative care or at home. Is that what you're
saying? Well, I can't make a comment about home, but certainly within the acute care sector, I worry that they don't have adequate support and relief of symptoms and support of the families. And
yes, Nick.
Can I say something a little bit controversial? I think that we're medicalising dying too much. We've got to normalise it. It's all going to happen to us, and by medicalising it and making it medical failure that someone dies, that just sets up this whole community expectation of what acute care does. You know, you go to acute care and you get saved. Well, no, that's not going to happen every time.
Yeah, but isn't this whole discussion around palliative care, and I might even bring in Dr. Michael Chapman, who's Director of Palliative Care at Canberra Hospital, the research is suggesting that palliative care itself is far too narrowly defined, Michael Chapman, that it should be far more broadly used and brought in much earlier, whereas it's brought in towards the end and seen as... this is not a fair comment. Last gasp work, if you know what I mean. Now, do you yearn for a broader understanding of palliative care?
Yeah, thanks for the question. And I absolutely do. And I think the comment about it being a last gasp, while it's on some levels unfair, is actually, you know, unfairly also how it's often perceived, you know, I think in our community at the moment, both amongst clinicians and our general population. But we've got really, really good evidence, really compelling evidence to say now that early integration of palliative care, early offering of palliative care to people who've got some kind of serious illness makes all kinds of really beneficial differences to the experience of their lives from that point, and even in some cases, maybe even how long they live.
Yes, and there's some evidence to show that they live longer.
There is. And that's certainly an area for further study. But I think, to me, one of the things that this is fundamentally about is about a misunderstanding of what palliative care means. I constantly have conversations with my colleagues, doctors, nurses, and you know other people working within healthcare. It quite transparently is all about trying to make sure for people who've got some kind of serious illness, making sure each day is as good as it can be, in whatever way that might mean. And it's actually not a scary idea. When you talk to people about it like that, actually people pretty quickly say, yep, I want some of that.
I saw someone recently who was told that they were handed over to palliative care to our team.
That was the verb.
They were handed over. that's often said in hospitals. But they were handed over, told that they had 2 weeks to live. And this gentleman was, I mean, I'm a psychologist, so I saw he asked to see the psychologist. It was 5 weeks past the time he was 3 weeks past his use-by date, as he put it. But he was stuck in trauma because he had been told and handed over in such a dramatic way. And one of the ways that he kind of had to become unstuck was to really think about how did he want to live? Mm. And that's the part that Michael's talking about. But once he did that, him and his family got energised about how are we going to support each other now for however many weeks or days Dad has left.
Do you know how long he did have?
He's still going, as far as I know.
Oh, isn't that... And look, this is very interesting. I wonder if the repositioning of palliative care as a term might actually aid this very death literacy that we're talking about. Nikki?
So I think what we've tried to do is to make it usual care, okay? So it's not something that has to be introduced. It's usual care. It's part of your care. So that's what we've done in residential aged care. We are part of the care team. So everyone's getting it. And that can only be done through true integration, which is really important. If we don't talk about this and offer it, the risk we have is people suffering, and they shouldn't be suffering. I have so many people when I turn up to the door, thank God you're here. You know, thank you. Someone can help me. Someone can help my family. And someone's done this before.
Professor Mitchell?
So I think palliative care in some respects has already reframed us, the other clinicians, if you like, because one of the challenges I think palliative care faces, a little bit like intensive care, the owners of the patient, and I hate to use that term, but in the hospital, patients are owned. Mm-hmm. If you start threatening the ownership mm-hmm. of the patient, the clinicians become very unhappy. So if I go in and say, this patient really needs end-of-life care, they get very threatened that you've now challenged their way of managing a patient. If I use the language of palliative care, help me understand the goals of care. For some reason, that change, tweak in language suddenly makes them relax. And now we can start talking more realistically about what the next step should be. So I think already palliative care has changed the landscape in terms of, you know, let's talk about the goals, not just about, you know, are we going to put this patient for resuscitation or not.
Now, I must talk about voluntary euthanasia and assisted suicide, which is clearly occupies the headlines quite a lot. And I'd just like each of you to give a quick answer, if you could. Is this debate assisting people to have a better conversation or not? I wonder what you think, Karenin.
What I've observed is that a lot of the conversations do seem to be fear-based. That worries me a little. There isn't a lot of conversation about people kind of having normal deaths. They're not very sexy normal deaths. Mm. But many of us here see lots of normal, natural deaths. And that, for me, in terms of the discourse, has been a little challenging. Mm.
Professor Mitchell.
I think that it's not that I disagree with the conversation or that it should take place. I think that the challenge that I have, it just really is going to focus on such a few numbers of deaths that we really then might miss the main game in the conversation. And you talk about, you know, the limitations we have in resources of palliative care. I mean, that needs to still continue on as a mantra, that we still need more resources in terms of palliative care specialists or more broadly. So I guess I don't want it to derail it from the main game.
Nikki?
I think any talk about death and dying is a good thing, in my opinion.
But if it worries people and they start to believe that there's no alternative but acute pain at the end which has to be alleviated and indignity, does that help?
So that, well, palliative care is about looking after alive people. So if we go and talk to them and we tell them that we're here, we ask them what's important to you, what are you scared of, if they ask me to have suicide, which people do, I say, what is it about life that's so hard for you? How can we help you? And, you know, I've been asked that question multiple times, and they've all died without voluntary assisted dying, and I think they've died well.
Suzanne?
I think in the community, the topic is increasing the conversations in the community about dying.
Which is a good thing.
Well, it's a good thing, but sometimes it's misinformed, and so they're not necessarily aware of what palliative care can offer. So I think as far as having conversation, I think that's a good thing, but it needs to be a little bit more informed.
Well, look, I think there's some very fresh ideas there. Would you please thank Dr. Kerry Noon and Professor Imogen Mitchell, Ms. Nikki Johnston, and Dr. Suzanne Rainsford. And that discussion was held at Canberra Hospital as part of the Canberra Health Annual Research Meeting, supported by the ACT Health Directorate and Canberra Health Services.